Praise the Fools is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment.
Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/feastoffools today for details.
Sesame Street began in 1969 as a result of a question posed at a dinner party. Could television be used to teach children? Could learning be a form of entertainment?
After 40 years, the award-winning program not only taught oodles of children how to count and recite the alphabet, but also taught them to embrace diversity and inclusivity. Whether black or white, tall and yellow, or small and green, everyone had a home on Sesame Street.
We love the Muppets because, much like ourselves, they aren't perfect creatures. We see our own humanity in their furry faces and their beady eyes.
Sesame Street showed animals, monsters, and people living together and working through their differences. The show influenced a huge population of children that eventually grew up to love diversity, technicolor hair, and our nation's first black president.
Obama! On today's show, we're talking to author Michael Davis about his new book, Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. In his book, Michael takes an in-depth look at the groundbreaking program from its inception to the present day, covering some interesting behind-the-scenes conflicts which were part of the creative energy of the show.
Listen as we talk with Michael about hipsters and squares and the program's countercultural influence.
Kami, the HIV-positive monster from South Africa.
Bert and Ernie as gay icons.
And how they coped with the painful deaths of Jim Henson and other key talent behind the show. Plus, questions from you, our listeners. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fools. Today's Feast of Fools is brought Today's Feast of Fools is brought to you by the letters FOF and the number 926, and by generous support of fantastic listeners like you.
We really can't do the show without your support, so please visit our website, feastoffools.net, and make a donation, buy a t-shirt.
Your contributions make the show possible.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, is this Michael Davis?
It is.
This is Fausto Fernos.
And Mark Fillion from the Feast of Fools podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thank you.
I heard you're stuck in the snow.
Not so bad here. At home, I understand there's 4 to 6 inches, but it's not so bad here. Where are you guys?
We're in Chicago. We're stuck in the snow, too, all the time.
In the city?
Yeah, we're in the city, in the north side, in Andersonville.
It's a sunny day. We're trying to sweep the clouds away, and we're talking with Michael Davis, who you put probably one of my favorite books I've read in the last couple of years, which is Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street and How It Came to Be.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, man.
It is really a fantastic book, and part of it is that if you are a big Sesame Street geek like I am, this is going to satisfy. It's like eating a big plate of lasagna, you know, when you're hungry for this kind of content and this kind of storyline. Now, what really impresses upon me is the atmosphere and how the show originally came to be in 1969. Can you talk a little bit about that? The famous dinner party at Joan Gantz Cooney's apartment in New York City?
Yeah, you know, Joan invited a small group of people to her apartment, and among the guests was a guy named Lloyd Morissette. And Lloyd was an experimental psychologist by training and was working for the Carnegie Corporation, giving out grants to programs across the country working with preschoolers. And they had a roaring good time at this dinner party. And after dinner, the conversation turned to a story that Lloyd told about his then 3-year-old daughter, Sarah. He found her in front of the television at 6:30 in the morning one Sunday watching the test pattern.
I used to do that, too.
I think a lot of kids do.
I know. I remember when we were used to doing it, we used to imagine there were like characters. Like the bars, those colorful bars that go doo. doing?
And I think a lot of our listeners probably have never even seen the test pattern, because now television's 24 hours a day now. So,
well, you know, for those who didn't see it, it was just a slide that the television stations would put up when they didn't have the programming day started quite yet. And it had this very annoying kind of boop, as we just heard. It was actually ear-splitting.
Like,
yes. So here was Sarah sitting transfixed in front of the set, and Lloyd thinking, what in the world is it about television that would lure a child out of bed at this hour of the morning to sit there and watch nothing? And he asked the question aloud at this party, you know, do you think that television could be perhaps something more than a great thief of time? Could television teach? And that question hung in the air for a while, and it really got things rolling. It was the instigating moment for Sesame Street, because Joan Ganz Cooney and Lloyd Morissette teamed up to create Children's Television Workshop, which in turn created Sesame Street. It all started with that question.
And isn't that a bit of a naive question to ask? I mean, by today's standards, of course, but even then, it's like kids had slideshows and film strips and other types of media. Why was this? What was the mystery about television so appealing to Joan and Lloyd?
Yeah, I think that I remember that era of television, and I might have asked the same question too, because the world of children's television was a bit empty back then, and there were so few attempts to do anything that would have promoted intelligence and would have challenged children. And, you know, I can understand why he might have asked that, especially as it regarded preschool children, because back in the day, there really wasn't all that much for them. There was Captain Kangaroo, and in some few markets around the country, Fred Rogers had already begun his show, but there was so very little out there for young audiences. And back then, you know, we didn't think very much of the capabilities of preschoolers. It wasn't until the 70s when there was a great awakening about the potential of preschoolers to learn, and you know how much they could learn, that they did in fact have an attention span, that they could retain, that they could learn the numbers 1 to 20 backwards and forwards and the alphabet and some basic sight words. So as crazy as it sounds, we didn't know that then.
Well, it seems like nowadays people always say kids are so much smarter than they are today than we were as kids and things like that. Was that something when you were younger? Was that true though? I mean, or did kids not know as much back then?
No, I think kids have always been smart. Mm-hmm. I think adults have been stupid.
But we're finally recognizing it is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, exactly, if you look at Howdy Doody, and I love reading about the problems and mistakes and how the guy who ran Howdy Doody, like, he like hated the kids, and he was like, get away. It was like an episode of The Simpsons, like reading Krusty the Clown is annoyed by the children.
Like Krusty. Oh, I sheltered myself. You know, Buffalo Bob really did have a deep disdain for the children. Yeah.
And, you know, and the producer, John Stone, sort of working, he was involved with a lot of those children television programs, and he kind of learned how not to do it.
Yeah. I think that it's amazing that the first producers of Sesame Street, first of all, they were all men, okay? And the entire world of children's television was comprised of men. And when you think about it, it's kind of stupid, because none of these guys had any expertise in child development or education or anything.
They came as entertainers, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Then putting a woman in the driver's seat, Joan Ganz Cooney, really was a historical and revolutionary thing to happen.
It definitely was. And she had but a bachelor's degree in education. I mean, she was no great scholar about child development and kids, but at least she had some grounding in it. It's an amazing thing that it took that long. It took till the late 1960s for that kind of show to coalesce and for that kind of energy to come together to give something better to kids. Because television, you know, had been around for a good number of years. And, it was just sort of a happy circumstance that PBS was just born right around that time. and it needed an identity. In a lot of markets, PBS was nothing more than a rumor. You know, you couldn't find it. It was on these UHF stations, you remember UHF, that were, you know, fuzzy and hard to bring in, and no one knew they existed.
What strikes me about Sesame Street is that it was sort of the first children's programming to be not just diverse in the sense of race, but also in terms of shape, size, and even it had single people and weird Muppets, you know, like the whole idea of Bert and Ernie, are they adults? Are they a gay couple? Are they children living alone? I mean, that the diversity that was presented in the show was really remarkable. And yeah. I'm wondering if they're, because
groundbreaking,
this is sort of like right at the cusp of the Nixon administration. And I remember Nixon trying to cut off funding for PBS and for Sesame Street specifically. But was there any kind of like debate or tension that we didn't get to see that may not have been touched upon in the book about how diverse to make this children's TV show?
Well, the originators of the show were gung-ho to do it. They all really sort of pledged allegiance to the same ideas of you know, creating a show that would promote tolerance and acceptance and definitely give children an idea that people could live together harmoniously. There wasn't a single naysayer in the bunch. So they're the ones who pushed it. In fact, they wanted to push it even further than they did.
And hence that why they brought in Jim Henson into the project of the Muppets.
You know, Jim was a friend of John Stone's, the guy who became the sort of the legendary executive producer of Sesame Street. And, you know, they decided that if they were going to have puppets, they were going to have Jim Henson. If they couldn't get Jim Henson's, they wouldn't have puppets, you know, because he was that good. In their eyes, and they all sensed that he could come in and sort of provide a missing alchemy to the show at a time when they were really, you know, stretching to try to find an identity. In the summer before it debuted, in came Jim Henson, and he responded so beautifully, not only with the Muppets that he created for the show, but, you know, a lot of those counting films that we remember so tenderly came from Jim Henson.
He directed and drew them, and he did it all.
He did it all, absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of those little live-action films that were so abstract and so memorable, Jim Henson did them. He had a little animation studio in the back of his workshop, and you know, he created the melodies with a Moog synthesizer. He was the first private citizen in the United States to own a Moog synthesizer.
I've worked on a Moog synthesizer. It's not easy.
No, it's not easy. And back then, they were about the size of a VW bus. I mean, they were huge.
So are you saying when Sesame Street first appeared, they didn't really have any puppets on it?
No.
The pilot shows.
The pilot.
The test shows that they created in the summer before it launched. In fact, the street scenes in those pilots bombed with kids. They had little focus groups of preschoolers, and they hated the street scenes because the scenes were populated only by the actors. And it wasn't until after they reviewed those tests that they realized that they needed to go ahead and populate the street with fantasy characters as well as you know, the reality of actors.
Well, that's always been sort of like a dark side of Sesame Street, is that they're a street. And even, you know, when Barney was threatening Sesame Street in the 90s, Sesame Street responded by, like, expanding the neighborhood to make it look cleaner and more fresher. But for a good 20 years, it was this, you know, a real urban environment populated by Muppets and
there was a grit to it, and by design, they wanted Sesame Street to look like a neighborhood in Harlem, complete with the brownstone and the stoop. And yes, you're right. In the 90s, Sesame Street became a bit gentrified, and they lit it differently. They painted it differently, and it did take on brighter hues. But for a very, very long time, it did looked like an urban street that might have been Chicago or Detroit or anywhere else.
Well, you know, Michael, it's really because of Sesame Street that so many people in my generation dye their hair blue or orange or red. And
well,
certainly,
that's so true. I hadn't thought about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, our comfort with piercings and hair color and body adornment really, I think, is an impact from us growing up and accepting these richly diverse fantasy characters.
Yeah, if you only had googly eyes like Cookie Monster.
I know some people who do have that naturally. Remember, folks, today's Feast of Fools podcast is brought to you by generous support of listeners like you and by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 35,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like Feast of Fools.
Log on to audiblepodcast.com/feastoffools to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Again, go to audiblepodcast.com/feastoffools for your free audiobook.
Did you know that Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street, the book that we're featuring on today's show, is available for free on audiblepodcast.com/feastoffools when you sign up now? They're giving the book away. Michael still gets paid. But with their Audible is taking a hit to stimulate the economy and get this fabulous book into your hands. So this is a very special offer, just available for the limited time. So check it out. audiblepodcast.com/feastoffools for your free audio book. And certainly, you know, Barack Obama becoming elected president is part of the fact that we saw interracial and people relationships and people of all different races getting along and not sort of fighting with each other so much.
I totally believe that. I think that slice of the electorate aged, 25 to 40, definitely got their first glimpse of what a neighborhood of tolerance and acceptance could be by watching Sesame Street. And really, what was Gordon if not a community organizer?
He sure was. Well, during this whole past election, I'd been saying, too, because they kept talking about Main Street USA, Main Street USA, and I said, you know what's created this presidency? It is Sesame Street.
Yes. Well, I'm so happy to hear you say that, and if your listeners believe that, run out and please buy Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street.
Oh, we got a fabulous deals for your book today. We got links to the audiobook through Audible and through the hard copy through Amazon.com. And I personally highly recommend it. I've already gotten a lot of my friends to read it already. What made you as a writer? You're a television writer mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And you write for the Oprah Winfrey magazine.
You write about television.
Oh, yeah. Right. For TV
and
Guide.
I'm still retaining water.
What made you want to be the unofficial biographer for Joan Ganz Cooney and Sesame Street?
Well, earlier in my life, back when dinosaurs were roaming the earth, I was a preschool teacher for Head Start, and I've always loved preschoolers. They're my favorite little critters, and so there's that. And I covered children's television at TV Guide for a long time. And because so few people do, it was a beat that just satisfied me in ways that I just can't tell you how much fun it was to get to know the gatekeepers of content at Nickelodeon and Disney Channel and Discovery Kids and all those great places. And during that time, earlier this decade, I did a story about Sesame's 35th anniversary, and I realized in doing the reporting for that piece that no one had ever done the book on Sesame Street, and it just seemed clear to me that it's a topic that I could embrace. And when you write a book, man, you got to be in love with the topic because you get up every single day to work on it. It's like being married to it. So you better love it. You better have a passion for it. And so that answers the question. I was passionate
And you got away with the title Street Gang? I mean, it's like, did Joan turn and go, I don't know about that?
No. And it was my idea. It popped into my head on the train ride home one night, and no one's ever uttered a negative word about it. Now, the people at Sesame Workshop sort of dig it. And, my hat's off to them. I mean, they let an independent journalist come in and, rifle through all of their records and archives, and I was never stopped from talking to anyone over the 5 years, and they were just tremendously courageous to let me come in and do that work without censorship or looking over my shoulder ever.
What was the biggest surprise for you when doing this research?
That Sesame Street almost went out of business in the early 70s. I had no idea.
In the 70s? When at the height of its success?
Yes. When just about every child in every stroller had a Bert or Ernie doll or a Cookie doll, they were on the ropes because the show had gotten so expensive, and all of the seed money from the federal government and from the Ford Foundation, wherever, had dried up, and they had to scramble very, very quickly to keep both Sesame Street and the Electric Company on the air. And I got to say, had there never been a Sesame Street and only been an Electric Company, it would be seen as the greatest children's show of all time. I'm totally a big fan of the Electric Company.
What's the music to me? I actually, at the gym, I listen to the Electric Company.
Oh, you do? Cool.
I do. One of my favorite songs is, "My name is Jim, Jim is my name."
So how did they save Sesame Street? Was it through merchandising? Because merchandising pulled through for them a couple of times in their history.
Yes, yes, yes. And not only did it save Sesame Street, it kept Jim Henson's company afloat because Jim was famously over budget on his movies and his projects. Mm-hmm. And had it not been for the consistent stream of revenue created by the licensing and merchandising of the Sesame Street characters, he would have gone under.
Well, and how did that work exactly? Because Jim Henson had Muppets, but he also had Sesame Street characters, and it kind of seemed like they overlapped or they were separate entities. Mm-hmm. And now, like, Kermit, is he even on Sesame Street anymore? Some of them, you know, I don't know.
Yes. The universe of Muppets Jim Henson created for Sesame Street were, in his eyes, unique and sort of they belonged to children, even though he own the trademark to those characters. And one of the stories that I take you on in the book is the incredible and unlikely journey that the characters went on after Jim Henson passed in 1990. And now the trademark rests with the folks at Sesame Workshop, and the trademark to the so-called classic Muppets, the Muppets of the Muppet Show and the subsequent movies, rests with Disney. How they got there is a story that makes your eyes roll back in your head. But Jim Henson got exactly what he wanted. He wanted the, you know, he wanted Ralph and Piggy and Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem in the hands of Disney after he passed, and he wanted Cookie Monster and Grover and Big Bird in the hands of Sesame Workshop, and that's exactly as it...
Because he believed that the Sesame Street characters belonged to children?
Yes, yes, and he did not think that Disney would sustain them in a way that would stay true to the mission of Sesame Street, and I think he's right.
So what is the biggest misconception that the public has on this television show? That you're hoping to dispel with this book?
That Bert and Ernie are gay. They're happy, but they're not gay.
That's my next question. I mean, it's sort of unusual because I think once especially after Jim, around the time Jim Henson passed away, and really impresses upon me, they were trying to diversify the cast, and there were a lot of like activists involved that behind the creation of Zoe, for example, the character.
Oh yeah.
They wanted to have a successful female Muppet.
Yes, but, in the worst way.
And I know from personal relationships that there are a lot of people who are connected in the scene in New York City, and Richard Hunt was one of famously openly gay Muppeteers.
Yes, he was.
And, was there ever a discussion about Bert and Ernie's unusual relationship?
Well, I'll tell you this. It, not only was it a discussion, it was fodder for some of the funniest skits ever in their rap parties every year. And it's
what?
No,
really?
Oh, yes.
Tell me about this.
No surprise at all that Avenue Q grew out of Sesame Street. That a good number of the cast members performed on Sesame Street and still perform on Sesame Street. Stephanie DeBruzzo, who went to Northwestern and is a fantastic puppeteer and was the original Kate Monster, still works on Sesame Street. So, you know, certainly they played with that notion and laughed about it and enjoyed speculating about Bert and Ernie. But, you know, the truth is that those characters are a projection of the real-life friendship between Jim Henson and Frank Oz. And Jim was tremendously mischievous like Ernie, and Bert and Frank share a kind of conservative stiffness, although Frank's a wonderful guy. And you know, anybody who's capable of creating Cookie Monster and Grover and Bert has got to be an exceptional person. But I have to say that Jim Henson and Frank Oz could be the grand marshals of the heterosexual pride parade. They both like women a lot.
I saw a gay couple dressed up as Bert and Ernie this year for Halloween, and it was like just slightly dressed up and like lightly with the makeup, and his nose was red like Ernie's, and he looked like a drunk. So I was thinking, geez, was Ernie a booze hound?
Well, I think it's interesting that in all great works of art, that people see different things about themselves. I mean, you write it extensively about how the song Being Green meant different things to different people.
Indeed.
And, I mean, certainly I see that Jim Henson had a lot of these intensely romantic platonic relationships with the people around him. He called Joan Ganz Cooney his non-sexual wife.
Yes.
And, yeah. And you know, and
like having a wife, lots of deep conversation and no sex.
Yeah, and I would say that that's very similar to his relationship with Frank Oz. And certainly, you know, I mean, Frank Oz trusted him so much that one good story in your book that I loved is that backstage on Saturday Night Live, I think it was, they took him a photo of him naked for a gift that he gave to him.
Yes, yes. And Frank had so much trust in Jim that he never even questioned why Jim had asked that he be able to take a picture of him sort of naked, but his hands covering his genitals, and he sort of bent over toward the camera. And Jim, for Christmas, made Frank this incredibly intricate gift basically it was a statue of Bert, and you look inside Bert's brain and you see Frank, a little picture of Frank Oz naked, which is so funny.
Well, and it's sort of, you know, it really illustrates the subversive nature of Jim Henson and his work. Yes. Will there ever be another Jim Henson or another Sesame Street? I mean, it feels like this was kind of like a unique historical coming together of minds and people.
Yeah, that's how I see it. I think there'll never be another Jim Henson, and certainly, you know, none of his children are exactly like him. And I think the closest thing you can come to Jim Henson in the world of the Muppets is Kevin Clash, who is Elmo. Kevin is like Jim, a director or producer. He performs a character that has entered the culture. Kevin travels the world and trains puppeteers for co-productions of Sesame Street on every continent but Antarctica. So, and Kevin Clash is black and from Baltimore. And, you know, it's just such a funny thing that this kid growing up in a basically a blue collar area.
I've met a lot of the Henson, the Henson family members, and what impressed me upon them is how much they physically resemble
Muppets.
The Muppets.
Oh, that's
like,
funny.
Because we were hung out with Heather Henson in Los Angeles, and when I walked into the restaurant, we were hanging out with her. She was wearing a giant pink wig, pink eyelashes, a pink kimono, and she looked like a spitting image of Prairie Dawn.
Wow.
And I have to say that maybe subconsciously, like, Jim Henson thought about his children and the Muppets as one and the same in a lot of ways, and he gave a lot of love to his family, but also to what his work.
Wow. And Heather's one of the Henson children I've not met. Pink wig.
Wow. Oh yeah, I'll email at the end of the show. We'll trade email addresses. I'll email you some fabulous photos of her.
Yeah. Who knows what Jim Henson would have done had he lived? You know, he was capable of so much, and he was always sort of technologically 20 years ahead of everybody else.
Sure.
And you know, back when he died in 90, he was already imagining what he could do with CGI and a marriage of those computer-generated techniques and traditional puppetry. He wanted so much to create, and that's why he wanted to sell the core business so that he could go back to being a performer and a creator.
Let's talk about the controversy surrounding the HIV-positive Muppet Kami from South Africa, from Tekalani Sesame. Yeah. What was the motivation of creation of that character, and why was that was made for the Sesame Street that is exported for South Africa?
Yeah, but it wasn't until knuckleheads here, including Rush Limbaugh, took that story and twisted it and tortured it that it became known to Americans that this was happening. The folks who do the co-production in South Africa were doing very meaningful work in creating a character that children could learn about HIV/AIDS from in a country where it is epidemic. And, you know, in the hands of certain broadcasters and irresponsible journalists in the United States, you know, it was made to seem like any minute now you're going to turn on PBS and there'd be an HIV character on the American version of Sesame Street. And, you know, it became a cause celeb. And
a cause to tear the Children's Television Workshop apart?
Well, they were flabbergasted more than anything else because mm-hmm. they knew what they were doing was, you know, God's work on earth. Goodness gracious, you mm-hmm. know, they were helping a country with a major problem, and to see it bastardized in the American press was just exasperating to them. And also to see what happened when, you know, they were trying to respond to the problem of childhood obesity in the United States by, you know, creating a little storyline for Cookie that, you know, he mixes in a salad every once in a while, and that cookies are a sometimes food and not a every time food. And, you know, that got twisted into, you know, Cookie doesn't eat cookie anymore, and, you know, he's gotten politically correct. And so that really blew up in their faces in a big way.
Because they had Cookie Monster wrapping healthy food. It tastes so good.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite scenes of Sesame Street is seeing him. But I don't know. I mean, is it a situation where you know, when you're creating programming for children, you're scrutinized more than if you were sort of creating entertainment for children?
Yeah, and also when you're talking about a show that touches people so deeply and is such a part of their childhood. That people feel a sense of ownership, and you know they don't want it to change. They simply don't want people to mess with the core characters or the mm-hmm. message of Sesame Street. So sometimes adults can act very foolishly about the show. After all, it is a television show. Hello, and you know they are puppets, and you know the times change, ideas change, and I think it was a very smart idea to create. Some funny segments involving Cookie Monster and healthier foods, and in typical Sesame Street fashion, they did it, you know, with great good humor and very funny songs, and I thought it was a great idea. But somehow, after it goes through the funhouse mirror of American
media
segments of American journalism
of the haters, let's just call them. They're not even journalists. They're just Street, professional haters.
Sesame yeah. Street has changed.
Journalists, I guess.
Sesame Street has changed over years because you know Kermit used to. When I was a kid, Kermit was the star, and yeah. now the star is this thing I've never even heard of named Elmo.
Yeah,
tickle me.
Well, I've heard of Elmo, but I've never like watched the show with Elmo. How does that change? How do they introduce characters into it? And how do these characters rise to such prominence?
Well, there's a good way and there's a bad way, and in the book I give a pretty good example of the bad way to do it and how Zoe got her start, and you know, they basically she grew out of the marketing department mm-hmm. at Sesame Workshop, and that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to give the writing staff a challenge, and that's how the new character Abby Cadabby was born. In fact, Abby was the brainchild of a man who is in his late 70s, a guy named Tony Geis, who's been writing for Sesame Street for lo these many decades, and he's the one who came out with the idea that they could have a fairy godchild, and that her lot in life was to study, become someday a fairy godmother. And and Abby is just a delightful new character on Sesame Street. I don't know if any of your listeners would agree if they have small children in the house, but I think they've done very well by that character. And it's always a marriage of great writing and great performance when you have a character that clicks on Sesame Street, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about probably the most famous character at this point is Elmo.
Yes.
Was originally wasn't created by Kevin Clash. It was nope. created by Richard Hunt. Is this true?
Well, yeah. Richard Hunt was the second person.
The second guy. Okay.
To take a whack at bringing this character to life, and sometimes that happens. You know, they the talent puts on a puppet, and they just can't seem to get the right attitude, the right affect, the right voice, and they get exasperated. And in the case of Richard Hunt, he literally threw Elmo to Kevin in the Muppet Room, they call it. It's sort of like a writer's room for the Muppets, and tossed it in the air. Kevin caught it and put it on and started playing with it, and went back to Baltimore to the in-home daycare center that his mother runs, and that's where Elmo really came to life, entertaining his little kids in his mother's homes. And the voice he had been doing for a really long time, but you know, the spirit of Elmo, I think, comes from Kevin's mother, a woman named Miss Gladys, who runs the daycare center.
So Elmo's like a drag queen in a sense.
Yes, that's right.
This is like, you know, even like Janice, I mean, Clarabelle the cow, they have a lot of like a gay, campy sensibility to that.
Yes.
You know, and not that to say that all the people who work at Sesame Street are gay, but they have gay friends, and some of the people are gay, and there is a certain like an urban sensibility.
Yes.
When Barney and his sort of saccharine iron content came in and threatened Sesame Street's financial viability, how was that like a sort of a wake-up call, or would they say, you know, are we too urban, are we too sophisticated for children? Or
At least the writers, their reaction was, what the hell? I mean, here we have this incredibly sophisticated show written by comedy writers, and we've been king of the hill for the longest time, and along comes this show that looks like it was shot in somebody's basement with characters that, you know, look like they were created over a weekend, and, you know, they couldn't understand the rocketing to popularity that Barney experienced in the 1990s, and they were really put off by it. And management at Sesame Workshop at the time was saying, look, we need to figure out what it is about this show that's so appealing to today's preschoolers, and you guys shouldn't be, you know, sticking your fingers down your throat and making the throw up sound. Find out what it is that's clicking with this show with kids. And so there was a real battle that went on between the old line writing staff and some of the actors, actually, and the management at Sesame Workshop. They were saying, look, we're losing market share because of this purple dinosaur, and we want it to stop.
So what was the key? Yeah. What was the key to Barney's success? What lessons did they learn?
The only answer that I can give you is the adults who had their kids watch Barney are the kind of adults who raise their voice like real high when they're talking to children. Oh, aren't you cute? Those people are, they're the ones.
Well, you know, they buy dolls too, you know.
Yeah. I don't know.
Is that sort of why Elmo's like taking over Sesame Street? Because he's kind of that way. Like, I have a goldfish as a friend. You know,
Yes. And the truth is that Sesame Street's core audience grows ever younger, and the two-year-olds really like Elmo, and two- and three-year-olds, and I wish I had a dollar for every time someone said to me over the 5 years of research, my child's first word was Elmo, not mommy, not daddy, not cookie, not cheese, Elmo.
Oh, that's funny.
In fact, I think they come out of the womb actually saying Elmo these days. Kevin Clash has a near mystical ability to communicate with 2 and 3 year olds, and that's who hooks on to Elmo in a big way.
Do you think it has something to do with the voice, how high it is, and that children respond to that highness?
Yes, it's talking in the third person like a lot of young preschoolers do. It's his color, it's his affect, it's his joyfulness, and the rest of it is mystery. Mm-hmm. There's just something.
It's that mouth. You can't stop staring at that. Void in there. It's like it's the eyes and the mouth just like suck you in, and you just can't stop staring at them.
Yes.
Did you hear about the dolls, the Elmo dolls, a few years ago that had the chip replaced and it said, "Who wants to die?" So is
that's
that,
twisted.
Yes, I don't know who did it, but they
who wants to die? Who wants to die?
Elmo does.
So who's your favorite Sesame Street character, Michael?
Oh, without doubt, it is Grover.
Not Oscar on the cover. Why don't you put Grover on the cover? I'm wearing a Grover t-shirt right
choice.
Now.
It was Viking, my publisher, mm-hmm. who made that choice, and I think it was a brilliant one, because if anybody's going to tell you the truth about Sesame Street, it's going to be Oscar in a sort of unvarnished way. And I think Oscar is the character that, when we grow up, we recognize why Sesame Street included Oscar, because we all, at one time or another, worked for an idiot boss. And I think he's the idiot boss character. He prepared millions of children to work with the a-hole.
So, well, you like what is it that attracts you to Grover then?
Well, I, like a lot of second ward children, I see myself in Grover. You know, I had a brother, an older brother, and there were 150,000 photographs of him as a baby, and there were 12 of me, and I was always like, hello, hello, trying to get people's attention and trying so hard. And you know, I thought I was a superhero and not a very good one, just like Grover. And I was indefatigable and unsinkable like Grover. I think a lot of second-borns see themselves in...
So I certainly do.
Grover's, yeah. Grover's a middle child, huh? Yeah. Wow, there's so much psychology
behind
Grover's this stuff.
I think Grover's the best teacher among the Muppets. I think mm-hmm. the segments where he is teaching a concept tend to stick with children more than any other character, including near and far, you know?
I was about to say that. So yeah. if Grover's your favorite character, what do you think is the best or the most significant Sesame Street episode?
Mr. Hooper's memorial show. I think that was absolutely the most significant piece of work they ever did. And the gutsiest to, you know, in television, when an actor dies, they do one of two things. They either replace the actor with another, mm-hmm. or they make up some stupid story about, you know, the character moving to Florida to live with his sister or something. Here, creators of television said, no, we're going to deal with this head on, and we're going to try to the best that we can explain death to very young children, because... Listen, kids lose their grandparents or their parents mm-hmm. at a very young age, and there are children who have to deal with this all the time, so let's take a whack at it. And as it is with every tricky concept that Sesame Street tries to teach, they brought in wonderful consultants from the world of psychiatry, psychology, from... you know, the worlds of education and child development, from people from divinity schools, and they gave the writers what they call a curriculum bath, that they immerse them in the research, and then the writers come out of it knowledgeable, and then they have the opportunity to take what they've learned and translate it into a script that is entertaining and educational at the same moment. And in the case of the episode where Big Bird learns of Mr. Hooper's death, I just think it's so moving. It's so beautifully wrought and so convincing. You could go to YouTube any day and watch it. And, you know, I've had grown people tear up watching it in front of me as I've discussed it. You know, that for a lot of people, it was the first time they ever had to deal with death.
And it explains death in an accessible way to children, but also to adults in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, no matter what culture or what religion you're talking about, death is always, memory is always associated with death. People, you know, always say that, you know, the way to honor those who have departed is through your memory and talking about them and holding your memories close to your heart. And that was a great message for kids to learn.
Well, I think death was pretty significant behind the scenes. Certainly Jim Henson's death. Untimely death, and Joe Raposo from cancer, and then Richard Hunt from AIDS. How did these behind the scenes death impact Sesame Street and the Children's Television Workshop?
Each one of them was traumatic. Each one of them was a setback, and a lot of these men died sort of one right after the other during a period of great loss and change at Sesame Workshop, and they weathered a lot of misfortune, and it's a great credit to Joan Ganz Cooney as the uber leader of Sesame Workshop that she kept things together and they marched forward and they did the right thing by these men who passed and their families and they still talk about them and still honor them in significant ways. So as an institution, they tend to do things very well there. You'd want to work for them.
I certainly know. I'm inspired just by reading about Joan Ganz Cooney and her leadership style.
Yes.
Why do you think she was so able to like motivate and inspire people the way she did?
Well, I can tell you that I spent a good deal of time with her over the 5 years. We had these 90-minute sessions in her office where I interviewed her, and she's the most impressive public figure I ever met because she's so direct and honest. I don't think she's capable of telling an untruth. When you're in her presence, you feel like this is somebody who really is very, very intelligent, but never kind of has to flash it in front of you, and somebody who has a deep appreciation for talent, somebody who really understands television and its potential, and somebody who leads by example. She was that rare bird who could hire great people and then step away and allow them to do their jobs. I don't know if you ever worked for anybody like that. I did once in my life. And what a pleasure that is to have the confidence of the person who hired you to make your own decisions and to feel completely liberated in making, you know, the decisions that you think are best for whatever creative enterprise you're working on.
Well, and certainly television is dominated or populated by a lot of control freaks.
Well, yeah, everyone wants to give notes. Even the secretaries want to give notes in television. The guy who empties the cans at night wants to give notes. It just doesn't happen.
Well, they must get together and talk about where they want to go and what they want to do and things like that.
Yeah, but it's always in the spirit of collaboration. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make it sound like it's kumbaya. You know, they clash, and there are a lot of clashes in the book where I discuss, you know, moments where people didn't agree. But what's different about Sesame Street is that from the very beginning, they all sort of pledged allegiance to this ideal, to the idea that they were going to create an experimental show that would continue to look for ways to make a difference in children's lives. And that pledge, that spirit, lives on.
But these children grow up. And a lot of the people that were influenced by Sesame Street are now people like me who do programming themselves that has a lot of echo. I mean, people always ask us, like at the beginning of the show, where why do we have this sort of like 70s retro sensibility and sort of like a there's a lot of flavor to even to this podcast. And I said, well, it's thanks to Sesame Street and Joan Ganz Cooney and John Stone and all these fantastic people.
Well, that's great. I'm so happy. And you turned out okay.
I turned out pretty well.
There's some problems there, but that's for another
show. I did have my hair blue for about 5 years, and then people, I used to get the nickname Grover. And so it is interesting to hear your thing. We got some questions from our listeners for you, Michael.
All right.
And they come through us through our Facebook group, Feast of Fools. And the first one comes from RJ in Chicago.
And he asks, are any of the characters based on real people? And where did they come up with the ideas for all the different characters, you know, the monsters?
Well, I think that the characters are amalgams of many people. I don't know of one in particular who is representative of a single individual, although Don Music, if you remember Don Music,
I banged my head on the piano myself.
Yes. I think that was an ode to Joe Raposo in a funny kind of way. And you know, they won't show Don music anymore because, of course, there was an epidemic of children banging their heads on the piano.
I did it myself, and I'm fine.
No.
Yeah, well, say, it's not so much that the kids' heads are getting hurt, it's the piano that suffers.
How funny is that? So, you know, the political correctness certainly has creeped into Sesame Street, and they, to my great regret, they don't do very much slapstick anymore, and I love slapstick.
I mean, Jim Henson's like Muppets used to eat each other.
Oh yes,
and you never see anybody
blow each other away with cannons. And, yes, and sure. And do you remember the chef, the bakery chef, who would
the Swedish chef
down the stairs with 5 chocolate cream pies?
Oh, I love that. Yes.
Sure. Well, they don't show that anymore because so many children threw themselves down the stairs holding 5 chocolate cream pies.
Gary from Tucson, Arizona, who's the most influential Muppet from the show?
I guess I'd have to say Big Bird is probably the most influential. And, you know, I think when I say that is that Big Bird is inquisitive, and he frames his questions very well. And I think that Big Bird has encouraged millions of children to do the same, to follow in his big footsteps, to wonder about things and to ask about things in an appropriate way. And, you know, Big Bird deals with adults pretty darn well. And
he pissed off Mr. Hooper, though.
Oh, yeah, by never getting his name straight.
I think it was more than that. It was like, I like the adversarial quality that they had with each other. You know?
I loved Mr. Hooper's crankiness. And, you know, I'm Jewish, and so I saw a lot of cranky old Jewish men in Mr. Hooper. He reminded me of some of my relatives, actually.
That's funny. So Mark in Chicago wants to know, will the Sesame Street Muppets and the Muppet Show Muppets ever meet again?
Nope.
Never?
Because Disney
never
owns them.
So Kermit will never be on Sesame Street again?
I don't think so.
Well, they show him in reruns. I mean,
I think it would take an extraordinary circumstance for the people at the Walt Disney Company to allow Kermit back on the Sesame Street set.
But they do show Kermit like in old clips, though. I've watched the show recently. And
yeah, and if you buy the box set, Sesame Street Old School, Kermit is very much in evidence. In fact, in his wonderful guise as Kermit the Frog of Sesame Street News. You know,
Michael, I love that you can imitate, do flawless impersonations of all the characters.
Yeah, well, you spent 5 years with a bunch of puppets and see what happens to you.
I do the same thing. Eric in Chicago, how are the Muppets maintained and stored? What happens to the old ones when they can't be fixed? Do they go into a Muppet shredder?
They aren't treated like precious, you know, iconic characters. They, you know, the people there have a healthy sense of what they are. They're bath mats with appliques, essentially. And even Jim, God bless his soul, he used to carry Kermit around in a plastic bag. Oscar goes places in Carol Spinney's gym bag. And, you know, they're treated with care, and they have Muppet Wranglers, they're called, people who you know, repair them, and they go to the little Muppet hospital and all. But, you know, unlike some other puppeteers, notably Chicago's Bert Tilstrom, who thought Kukla and Ollie were real, and real children used to put them to sleep on the bed and say, the children are sleeping, which is kind of crazy. No, Jim never thought that they were going to
come
alive one day and be a real boy.
Well, what happens to Muppets when they die?
I mean, the physical, do they get destroyed? Like, you know, do they get destroyed or do they?
No, they treat them respectfully. And the Henson Company, to their great credit, has an archivist. They file things away. They give things to museums, to the Smithsonian. And they have a very healthy respect for what they've created and for their history. And they are very, very dependable about factual stuff about the Muppets. So they have that. But I don't think they
We were hoping they'd go into a shredder or something.
Well, an incinerator. I mean, I don't want that, but it's like, I would figure that like a lot of shoe stores, for example, they don't want people messing around with the creations. And so they make sure that no one gets to see them where their heads cut off or something like that.
Yeah,
so,
well, I think they're careful about that. But Carol Spinney is very careful to never let children see him sort of half in and half out of his costume.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that HBO special, though, where they showed Carol Spinney holding up Big Bird's head. I didn't realize he actually holds it up with one arm.
Yeah.
And this guy's like, he's still running this thing?
Yes, he's 75.
75-year-old man holding up a big giant head above his own. I mean, that's incredible
stamina.
He's got
to have a strong shoulder.
Yeah, I can't hold my arm over my head for more than 5 minutes without crying like a baby. So I don't know how he does it. Most of the Muppet performers are in exquisite physical condition.
Well, is that maybe why so many of the Muppeteers are men or male characters? It's more
that
it's physical?
To a point, but you know, now there are plenty of women who perform Muppets, and they too are in pretty good physical shape. You have to be, because you spend a lot of time on your knees and your back and in strange positions and clustered with other people. You know, whenever you have a little cluster of Muppets, you got to realize that underneath them is a cluster of people.
Mm-hmm.
They get to know each other very well.
Okay. So, and the last question we have from Eric in Kenosha. He wants to know, why does Elmo dominate half the show, and when will there ever be any content for gay parents like myself and our children?
Questions, really. Sesame Street has experienced a real change in the average age of their viewer. It grows ever younger. And so that explains why Elmo has so much of a presence on the show, and why he has his own segment at the end for 15 minutes, Elmo's World, and he's in so many of the opening stories at the beginning of the show. It's because he is it these days. And the second part of the question is really intriguing. I don't know when, but my guess is that they wouldn't run away from that topic at all. In fact, they would embrace it. And so I wouldn't be at all surprised if that would come soon, because, you know, they've been so good about single parenting and you know, Gina on the show adopted as a single parent in the last few years. And I could definitely see Sesame Street taking on that topic. And now that Margaret Spellings isn't Commissioner of Education anymore, or Secretary of Education, I don't think you're going to have a person in Washington who will be howling if they try to, you know, to do something a little different. Yeah.
It is interesting, though, because, I mean, certainly having a same-sex parent couple with children on the show would bring in a lot of controversy today.
I don't think they'd shy away from the controversy. I mean, I think they would do it. If they could do it well, they would do it.
Do you think that the most controversial moment for Sesame Street was Kami, the HIV positive Muppet? Or, I mean, in doing all this research, what got the most hated negative response?
I would have to say that that's probably it. But, you know, it's a long history, and they've tried a lot of things through the years. And at the very beginning, they used to get a lot of hate mail because they had an integrated cast.
Mm-hmm.
And the state of Mississippi refused to show Sesame Street at the start because there were white children playing with black children on the set. And they thought that was something that would be inappropriate for the citizens of Mississippi to watch in 1969. So, I mean, they've weathered all kinds of criticism and questions and quibbles, but, you know, the show's resilient, and, you know, they can always sick Oscar on anybody.
Well,
Oscar the Grouch, get him.
So sure. What do you want to leave people with your book? I mean, what is the legacy of this book, Street Gang, itself?
Well, what I want to leave with them is the idea that, you know, that sometimes in life a great idea arises and for reasons that maybe we can't always understand, that great people are attracted to that idea. And Sesame Street was a coming together of genius. And not only to get it started, but to keep it on the air, took so much energy and so much commitment, and that, you know, there's a power in a great idea, and you once you get it going, it has its own centrifugal force, and if you treat it well and nurture it, that centrifugal force will be there for as long as you need it to be. That's what I want people to take away from the book.
Michael, thank you so much for putting together this book. I've had such a pleasure and joy reading it.
Thank you.
It's a joyful book and immensely satisfying and informative.
Thank you so much.
And I've learned so much.
Visit the website, streetgangbook.com. I try to make it fun and entertaining, and people can very, very easily send me their stories about Sesame Street, and I read every single one of them and respond to everyone.
Oh, fantastic, wonderful. Michael.
Okay.
And you'll also do autograph versions of it, right?
I send out autographed book plates to anyone who wants them, and it's free. I just send it out in the U.S. mail, and I'm always happy to do so. So that, too, is very easy to find at streetgangbook.com.
Thank you so much, Michael.
All right.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael Davis lives in Yardley, Pennsylvania. He's the author of Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street, available on our website, feastoffools.net, and also on audiblepodcast.com/feastoffools.
But if you want to buy it through Amazon, just follow the link. You can follow any link from our website to Amazon and get the book. It's really a delightful read.
Michael is the senior editor and family TV columnist for TV Guide. And also, he's written for the Baltimore Sun and Chicago Sun-Times, and we were very thrilled to have him on today's show.
Absolutely. I can't wait to find out what his next book is. I bet it's going to be Electric Company.
Maybe.
I don't know. I want to remind people, too, that we really can't do the show without your support, so please visit our website, feastoffools.net. Make a donation, buy a t-shirt.
Yes, and actually, if you want to see a lot of the clips that we talked about that are available on YouTube, go to our website, feastoffools.net, and click on the show number today, which is 926. Today's Feast of Fools is brought to you by the letters FOF and the number 926. And it's actually functional, because if you actually type that in the search bar, you can find the show at the entry and see the YouTube references. You can see Kami, the HIV-positive Muppet, talking about her mother's untimely death in the box.
So sad.
And Big Bird realizing...
Her mother died in the box?
No, her mother died, and then she kept her mementos in a little box.
Oh.
So you can watch that very touching video. I also see Big Bird coming to terms with Mr. Hooper's death.
Oh.
So, and also the more joyful videos, like the Mana Mana guys, which I consider probably one of the high points of Jim Henson and Sesame Street's commercials. They didn't really teach anything except to have fun, like this show.
Absolutely.
The music featured on today's show is the techno remix of the Sesame Street theme song, Sesame's Treat, by Smart E, available on our website, feastoffools.net.
Yep. I want to say goodbye to everyone. I'm Mark Fillion.
I'm Fausto Furnos. Have fun. Bye-bye.